Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and checking on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Red Alveda. Today, he's running a little late. He'll be in a couple of minutes with us, so don't worry. He'll be here with us. This is a special edition. 1 week after the U.S. Open, we have everything for you. We have a full recap, top to bottom, from wall to wall of Dustin Johnson's win there. We're going to be talking also about Se-young Kim winning the major LPGA Classic in the playoff over Carlos Aciganda. Also, we'll talk about James Driscoll. He's returning to form and he won the Web.com Tour Nashville Golf Open. So don't go anywhere. We have Fred is here with us. So Fred, hi, how are you today?
Carlos, I'm really excited. Thank you very much. Sorry I'm a little bit late here. We're just filling the car, driving back from doing the media day for the U.S. Senior Open at Siler Country Club, and traffic and everything running a little bit late here today. So, but hey, Carlos, I don't know how far you got, but, you know, we saw one of the most controversial rulings ever made in golf on Sunday at the U.S. Open, and we're going to cover it from all angles tonight. Also, we have another win for the 2015 LPGA Rookie of the Year, Se-young Kim, at the Fire Classic. Plus, we have more on the Olympics, and Donald Trump is back in the news this week, Carlos. So I know that excites you. Let's go.
Let's go. Let's start right away. Like you mentioned, we're going to be talking about the U.S. Open top to bottom, wall to wall. We're going to start right now on the weekend backswing, telling you about the results. But today, on our practice range, which is our topic of the week, we're going to be talking about the controversy that happened to him. So you don't want to miss that. And Fred was with Jeff Hall, the USGA's managing director, and we have some words from him. So you don't want to miss that as well. But let's start right away by recapping what happened with Dustin Johnson, who won the 2016 U.S. Open at Oakmont. You know, it's been a long time coming, but he finally has won a major, and he darn well earned it. DJ has played his way into contention on so many major Sundays but in his time, but he succumbed to the bunker debacle the Hassel time, made that infamous three-putt a year ago at Chambers Bay, and has had numerous close calls before. But this year, he finally got the breaks to go his way with his thundering drives and all-around great ball striking. I mean, the biggest break of the week came when he was when his wayward drive went on the on 10, found some of the gnarliest rough on the golf course. To his delight, he was able to take a line-of-sight relief due to a television tower between his golf ball and the flagstick. He picked his ball up out of the rough, and two drops later, placed it gently atop the first cut, hitting right over the tower anyway. He made a routine par and kept the lead he would never relinquish. Going to round four, it looked like it's going to be Irishman Shane Lowry's golf tournament to lose. He might have lost it with his final round 35, but take nothing away from Dustin Johnson. DJ absolutely set out with a goal in mind and accomplished it. He even battled through a conversation with rules officials regarding a ball that moved on the green hours later. Earlier, the man must have channeled his frustration after that because he hit a 370-yard drive on the par 5-12. It went even 20 yards longer than what Jason Day had been the longest one. He went 20 yards more, carrying the ball a whooping 328 yards down the left side of the fairway. Bouncing back from the heartbreak of an unfavorable ruling is not only the story of this tournament, it is the story of the last 5.5 years of Dustin's major career. Jim Furyk made a run with a final round of 66, getting to one under for the tournament. Good pick there from the from Fred last week. Well, number one, Jason Day, he caught fire. He had a chance after reaching 2-under thanks to an eagle at the 12th and a birdie at the 13th, but he finished double bogey, bogey, and fell back into a tie for 8th place, 3 back of Furyk. Scott Piercy, he hung around until the end, but he wasn't able to close the deal. Sergio Garcia, oh my God, he made a great move to get into contention on the front nine, reaching the turn in 33. But as is usual with him, he dropped 3 strokes in his last 5 holes and ended tied for fifth with Brandon Grace. At the end of the
week, your boy did it to you again, Carlos.
At the end of the week, weather delays, open rough, lightning quick greens, missed short putts, and interruptions by a rules official, and the thought of a possible penalty stroke that we're going to be talking later on being added to this round were not enough to keep the title away from DJ. I mean, I've heard it said that golf is 90% mental and the rest is in your head. This week, that was an understatement when it comes to Dustin Game. Dustin Johnson did not cause that ball to move on the fifth. I'll leave it at that, since that is the topic for the practice range today. But it doesn't even matter if it did. DJ hit the golf shot of his life on the 72nd hole, stuffing it inside 5 feet on the 72nd, rolling it for a birdie to finish 4-under after the penalty was finally assessed and erased all possible doubt. Brett Dustin Johnson is the U.S. Open champion. He has finally won a major, and he darn well earned it.
Yeah, it was quite a scenario. You know, Carlos, at the beginning of the week, you know, Monday through Wednesday in the practice rounds, the course was very firm and fast and difficult to even hold balls on the green, just like the USGA wanted it to be. As we heard Bob Ford say last week, they're always at the mercy of Mother Nature, and she reared her head on Thursday and the rains came down, making Oakmont softer. It did make the rough a little bit more difficult, however, it put an even higher premium on finding fairways. I really struggle to understand why the USGA and all of their wisdom feels they have to make these classic golf courses more difficult for a U.S. Open. Oakmont was plenty difficult even after the rain had slowed the greens and made the fairways wider. Only 4 players finished under par for the week, and the same amount of hacking among the best players in the world should have satisfied even the most sadistic of the Blue Blazer crowd. Shane Lowry, you mentioned, held the 4-shot lead heading into the final round. Everybody thought it was his to win. But he showed the nerves right off the first tee, overhooking nearly every shot. He finished with 3 bogeys on the front nine and 4 bogeys and only 1 birdie on the back for a 76 and finished runner-up, tied with Furyk and Scott Piercy. Andrew Landry, there's a story. We could spend all day talking about that. Playing in the last group with Lowry, he was tied with Dustin Johnson and minus 3 after 3 rounds. He was ranked number 624 in the world, but the pressure of the situation proved to be too much for him on Sunday. Thursday through Saturday, he was the model of consistency, striking fairways with a spectacular display of driving accuracy. But he was far too quick, which led to 5 bogeys plus a double that added up to a 42 on the front. He had 1 more bogey at the 10th and settled down to par in with a 78 and dropped a T15. All in all, though, it was an excellent week for the Texan. In 13 starts this year on the PGA Tour, he has recorded 6 missed cuts, and his highest finish before Sunday was a T41. The 155,000 he earns will go a long way to keep his card this year, and he moves from number 624 in the world to 379. Hey, let's talk about Dustin Johnson for just a second. You know, he had finished top 10 in 11 major championships since 2009, but always spit the bit. A couple of his failures in majors were fairly memorable, and that's what makes the final round ruling at Oakmont by the USGA even more ludicrous. Most noticeably, his implosion at the 2010 U.S. Open and his bunker fiasco at Whistling Straits in the 2010 PGA Championship. Oh, yeah, there was that missed putt at the 2015 U.S. Open last year at Chambers Bay that cost him another major. He has definitely had his chances, but this time, Carlos, he pulled it off with a little help from Shane Lowry and absolutely no help from the USGA. You know, one of the big stories, too, Carlos, was the failure of the big 3 or 4, however you like to add them up, to make an impact on the proceedings at Oakmont. Jason Day finished T8 after a final round 66 on Sunday. He tried to give it a go, but just couldn't sustain a solid round. Kind of the story of this week. Jordan Spieth made the cut, but fought his swing in the greens all week, 72, 72, 70, 75. Left in T37. To sum up his week, he finished bogey, birdie, bogey on the final three holes, kind of one step forward, two steps back for world number two this week. It appears that Jordan might be mentally not right. His meteoric rise over the last 2 years maybe is taking a toll on the young man. You know, he's got a lot more off the course obligations now, a lot of sponsor things that he's doing, and, you know, he just doesn't seem to have that spark, that pizzazz that we saw him have over the last 2 years. Hey, here's another name for you. Remember this guy, Rory McIlroy? He missed the cut. Rounds of 77 and 71. He was making noise on Friday, though. Starting on the back nine, he carded four birdies to get inside the cut line and back into contention for the tournament. But two doubles and a bogey on the second nine did him in. And he left in a huff, Carlos. Didn't even bother to stop to talk with the authorities, which is really unlike young Rory. Ricky Fowler, he played with Rory the first two rounds, and just like Rory, missed the cut. 76, 75, plus 11, trunk slamming, see you later down the road. Carlos, I got a couple more things here. I don't know if you want to cut in and say a couple things, and I'll finish up, or you want me to keep going. What do you want to do?
I just wanted to add, you know, Lee Westwood, who was also there in the mix, he was just two shots behind. And really on Sunday, I expected him to be close and to contend, but unfortunately he also went 11 under and he just disappeared from the show there. I mean, that was mind-boggling to me, Lee Westwood. I expected more from him. His final round was a nightmare, and he was closing on that automatic spot on the European Ryder Cup team, and now I don't know what's going to happen with him. But anyway, what else do you have for us on it?
Seven bogeys on the front nine, Carlos. Seven.
It
was incredible.
That sounds
like something I would do.
But no, it was a great tournament. Anyway, I mean, I'm very happy for Dustin Johnson. When we talked and we had been texting each other, I remember telling you, you know, it would have been an incredible storyline to have Dustin Johnson, Lee Westwood, and Sergio Garcia, all three trying to go for the first major, and all three went for it, but only one came out on top, and that was Dustin Johnson. And what a way did he to win, and at least there's just one off of those great players that haven't won a major now. He's off that list, and now it's off to Lee and Sergio to see if they can make it.
Yeah, a couple more points from the U.S. Open before we leave it. On the plus side, 46-year-old Jim Furyk, a hometown hero in Pittsburgh, posted a fine minus 466 on Sunday that left him at 1-under and tied for runner-up. I really thought one of the most impressive and overlooked performances of the whole tournament was turned in by Scott Piercy. He posted rounds of 68, 70, 72, 69 to finish at 1-under par and runner-up with Lowry and Furyk. He scrapped every day and put up consistently solid rounds. I thought he was very impressive with the way he played the tournament. Carlos, you mentioned your boy Sergio finished T5. Pretty good tournament for Sergio. Ball striking was the key to Oakmont, and Sergio, of course, is one of the best ball strikers in the world with his driver and long irons. He made some fantastic saves or pars from the thick, gnarly, rough, and deep bunkers. Another name that we've been talking about a lot over the last couple of years, Brooks Koepka, he had it going for a while on Sunday. He even had people talking about breaking Johnny Miller's longtime record at Oakmont 63. Excuse me. He began the front nine with bogeys at 1 and 3, then reeled off six birdies and an eagle in the next 8 holes, which put him at 6-under for the round with 7 holes to go. Evidently, he got a little scared of the scary heights and came back to earth with 4 bogeys on 14 through 17, posted a ho-hum, minus 268, good for T13, and an invite to next year's U.S. Open at Erin Hills. John Rahm, out of Arizona State, was a low amateur for the week and the only amateur to make the cut. He turned pro yesterday. Fox broadcast. Carlos, you know we're going to talk about Fox. We give them so much hell over the last year about the way they handled the broadcast last year. If I give them a grade this year, massive improvement with Zinger, Fax, Curtis, Flesh, all good. camera crew much improved. Tech assistance and graphics were usually good. A little too crowded on the screen for me, though. Second team in the booth was Shane O'Donoghue, and not so good. Holly, better in the studio behind the desk. He was a little stiff this year. Mark Brooks, not really primetime ready yet. And why do they have Shane Bacon doing anything? I can't figure that out. Overall, Collins, give them a B+. They definitely get the most improved, but they still got a lot of work to do to get it better.
Hey, and just two more names I want to add there before we move on. You know, Donnie Willard, he still has the green jacket that he won at Augusta and also a handsome trophy, right? But, you know, he no longer has the putter to help him win his first major championship 2 weeks ago. I don't know if you saw it. He broke it as he approached the conclusion of his third round there on Saturday and in the moment of rage caused by his bad putting. And, I mean, I would have done it earlier, but he waited until that point. And he was really not—he was not himself putting there. He couldn't.
Sometimes you just got to show him who's boss, Carlos. You can't take a lot of stuff from those putters. You just got to teach him a lesson once in a while.
Well, that one rests in peace right now. He has a new one. Hopefully, it'll work better for him. And Phil Mickelson, I don't know if we've reached a point when, you know, it's fair to assume that he won't win the U.S. Open. He had been playing as well as he could be. And he really didn't have it there also all weekend. I mean, he will still be one of the best ever, but I don't know really if he will ever finally complete his career at Grand Slam.
Yeah, I don't know about Phil in the U.S. Open. He's just not supposed to win it, I guess.
It seems like it. We'll see. Anyway, we'll leave it at there for now, but we have a lot more to come on the topic, practice range. We're going to be talking everything about the controversy from Dustin Johnson there. And like I said, Jeff Hall, the USGA managing director, is going to be on an interview that Fred had today with him. So we'll see his point of view at the USGA. But also, there was a tournament there in the LPGA where Korean Se-young Kim should pick up her second win of the 2016 LPGA Tour season in a playoff. She defeated Carlota Siganda on her first playoff hole to capture the Myers LPGA Classic for Simply Give at Blythefield Country Club in Belmont, Michigan. On Sunday, she earned $300,000 for it. Kim, who is the 2015 LPGA Rookie of the Year, and Siganda ended the regulation tied at 17 under 66. Kim shot a 68 while Siganda carded a 67 to set up the 7-day showdown. Kim only needed one playoff hole, and she birdied the par 4 18th while Siganda could only manage a bogey. Kim, who is only 23, won three times last year and is the second South Korean with multiple victories this year, along with Hana Yan, also a two-time winner this year. Kim, now the world's number 5, began the round in third place, one of the pace set by South Korean In Ji Seung and Lexi Thompson. Kim picked up two birdies in the front nine and had two more in the back nine before committing her only bogey of the day at the 18th. She dropped into that playoff with Siganda, but that very 18th hole served at the stage for more late drama for Kim, who improved to 3-0 in playoff finishes. Chung, the overnight co-leader, finished in third place alone at 15 under. Lydia Ko and Lexi Thompson finished tied for fourth, one shot back. Soyeon Ryu, she finished solo sixth at 13 under. Chun Chung Fong, solo seventh, and Asahara Munoz, solo eighth. Fred, the South Korean powerhouse contingent is something serious. It has 4 winners on the LPGA Tour this year, Kim, Yang, Hyo Kim, and Jenny Shin, and has 5 of the top 10 in the world, 7 of the top 15, and 11 of the top 23. And if they can start considering putting up an international tour there in Korea, it could really rival the LPGA in quality.
Oh, absolutely. And Carlos, before you get away from women's golf, I want to mention that on the Sumatra Tour, Jackie Stolting, who we saw on Big Break, won her second consecutive event at South Bend this week. So she's pretty much assured of her tour card for next year. So congratulations to her. And I think, on your point, I think Lexi is the only American to have won on the LPGA Tour this year. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Moving on,
true.
Carlos. Yeah, moving on to the web.com, there was a tournament last week in Nashville. James Driscoll, who's a PGA Tour veteran, won the first ever Nashville Golf Open on the web.com tour. Entering last week's Nashville Open, James hadn't done much to take advantage of a free pass he had received to be exempt for the web.com tour without needing to go through Q school because he had previously been on the PGA Tour for five consecutive years. But he'd missed 7 of 10 cuts this season and was standing a distance 144 on the money list. He just wasn't doing much with the opportunity. Things finally came together in Nashville this week, though. He fired a four-round total of 19 under par 269 to capture his second career web.com tour by three shots over Brian Campbell. Driscoll moves all the way to number 17 on the money list, and suddenly he's well-positioned to earn back status on tour, where he's played a total of 9 seasons. On the PGA Tour, Driscoll has entered 240 events, has 2 runners-up, 10 top 10s, 118 made cuts, and $5.7 million in total earnings. Carlos, that wraps up what I have on the backspin.
And we'll take now a short break, and when we come back, we're going to have the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. And Fred, you got the tee shot as usual, but you'll be talking about the caddies appearing in some tour lawsuit. So what is all this about?
Well, Carlos, you know, we had the news last year about the caddy lawsuit against the PGA Tour for monetary consideration for wearing those bibs that they force them to wear that have the advertising on them that they get nothing, no share of. So in the original lawsuit filed in January 2015, the lawyers for the caddies estimated the value of the advertising on the bibs at $50 million a year, for which the caddies received zero. Caddies are not prohibited from signing their own sponsorship deals, but the bibs cover valuable real estate on the caddy shirts that otherwise could be used to secure their own sponsors. Those claims were dismissed in February, if you remember, by the U.S. District Court of the Northern District of California in February, but this June 15th filing in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals argues that the dismissal was made in error. Judge, you screwed up. You shouldn't have done that. The 66-page brief includes several reasons the case should be allowed to continue, among them focusing on issues not included in the caddy's original lawsuit. So this lawsuit is filed on behalf of 168 caddies, saying the PGA Tour is violating federal antitrust laws by forcing them to advertise for the tour and its sponsors without compensation. So, Carlos, I just think the caddies really have something here. I think they have a viable lawsuit, and I really think the PGA Tour is going to end up having to pay them something down the road. So they probably are negotiating, but if they aren't, I urge them to get together and figure this thing out, because the caddies are too valuable to the tour. The tour needs them, and the caddies need the tour. So let's just work together. Let's figure this thing out. They can throw some bucks at them, and they'll all be happy. Even if they just put together a retirement plan or a medical plan and some, a retirement plan, I'm sure that'll work. All they got to do is do some of this stuff, Carlos. I'm sure they can do it.
Well, this isn't the end of it. I'm sure we'll be continuing. And as usual, we'll have every detail about it for you. And hey, we asked for forgiveness last week. We didn't have Donald Trump on the news here, but we have it. We said we were going to have him, and this week we have him back. So don't despair. Here he is. He scored a hole in one in his first year operating a new public golf course in the Bronx, racking up a city best $8 million in revenues there, while taxpayers shelled out $1 million to pay the course's water and sewage bills. That's what the New York Post has learned. The CD records show that the 237 million Trump Golf Links at Ferry Point hosted 28,291 rounds between its April 2015 opening and the end of March, netting nearly $3.8 million in green fees for Derek Donald, including other revenues such as $615,412 from merchandise sales and $514,223 from golf cart rentals. Ferry Point's gross receipts totaled $8.07 million, topping all city-owned courses. Records also show that under an unprecedented 20-year lease handed out during the Bloomberg administration, Trump doesn't have to pay the city a cent for the first 4 years Ferry Point is open. By year five, he has to fork over 7% of gross receipts or a minimum of $300,000. And by year 20, he pays 10% or a minimum of $470,000 to the city. Meanwhile, the course charges to New Jersey is $144 on weekdays and $172 on weekends to play 18 holes, more than triple what all other city-run courses charge. Trump enjoys another big perk. The city under Bloomberg agreed to pick up his course water and sewage fees. City officials say he was already reimbursed $1.05 million in water and sewage costs for a fiscal year ending in June 30, 2015, and they estimate will be reimbursed another $1.09 million for this fiscal year, which ends in June 30th. And although he's still responsible for spending $10 million of his own money to build an on-site clubhouse, such an addition is projected to significantly drive up his revenues because it would host large catered events. Some critics blasted what they called a sweetheart deal. I mean, Jeffrey Croft of Watchdog Group NYC Park Advocate said, and I quote, "It's like the city's actually paying Donald Trump to run a luxury golf course that caters to the rich," end of quote. Mayor Bill de Blasio spokeswoman Monica Klein declined to address Trump's earnings, but said the mayor will not go out of his way to do future business with him, while Hope Hicks, the spokeswoman for the Trump Organization, of course declined to address the course pricey fees or reveal how much the profit the company made.
You know, Carl, I just don't know how Donald has tried to do all this stuff. I mean, run for president, you know, fix up golf courses, make millions of dollars. The guy's amazing. He needs to be president. We need a guy like this running the country. He can do all this stuff at one time. Hey, Carlos, here's a story that I keep finding all this negative stuff about the Olympics. You keep finding all the positive stuff. But here's another negative one for you, Carlos. I'm sorry. According to a story in Reuters, Rio de Janeiro's governor declared a state of financial emergency Friday and requested federal funds to help fulfill obligations for public services during the Olympics that start August 5th. The request said emergency measures are needed to avoid a total collapse in public security, health, education, transport, and environmental management. The big problem is that the area's revenue is tied to petroleum, and it has been declining for the last 2 years. Brazil's interim president, Michel Temer, has announced that the federal government would ensure all obligations are met for a successful Games. The people are going to starve. They're not going to have jobs. We can't get them water, but we're going to have a great Olympics. Rio is expecting about 500,000 foreign visitors during the Olympics, which has coincided with Brazil's worst recession since the 1930s, and a political crisis that last month led to the suspension of the previous president. The state's financial emergency in no way delays the delivery of Olympic projects and the promises assumed by the city of Rio, Mayor Eduardo Paes said on Twitter. You know, we don't go to TV now or radio. We go to Twitter or Facebook. That's where everything happens. The local organizing committee for the Games said the state's fiscal situation did not impact its actual running of the Olympics, which relies entirely on private funds. I find it hard to believe because there's a lot of public funding going on, buildings and all kinds of stuff, sewage treatment plants that were supposed to be built, roads that were supposed to be built. Anyhow, while the majority of the Olympic infrastructure costs have been spread across city, state, and federal budgets with some financing from private companies, the state is responsible for most day-to-day security and health services in Rio. The financial pinch resulted in 30% cut in the state's security budget, just as Rio has seen. Oh, I'm sorry. Very sorry. It's cut forced some cuts in the security budget, just as Rio has seen a jump in homicides and assaults in recent months, raising concerns about safety ahead of the Olympics. Rio expects a budget deficit of over $5.56 billion. That's billion with a B, Carlos. Rio's debt issues have been downgraded several times. Rio has delayed pension and salary payments in closed schools and hospitals where crucial supplies, including medicines and syringes, are lacking. You know, Carlos, Brazil's under the microscope. Every little thing's getting reported. I know that ahead of the upcoming 2016 Olympics. But, you know, there's just a lot of stuff there that looks really bad. And I'm not even talking about the Zika virus. I'm letting that go and, you know, some of the other stuff. But they got a lot of problems down there, Carlos.
I'm about to cry here because you're letting go of the Zika virus.
I'm not even going to talk about it. I'm going to let it go.
I'm so proud of you.
You convinced me. It's a non-issue. Get off of it.
All right, all right. You know what? I don't know because this is something, and it happens in every Olympic Games. I mean, there are 10, I can mention 10 Olympic Games that bankrupt their host countries and cities. Of course, this is always the question, do the Olympics that host cities ever win? Of course, they never win. They just want to do the Olympics. And it's just mind-boggling. Everybody knows. If you didn't, everybody knows this is going to happen. If you didn't want that, hey, why did you run for it? There's going to be a lot of problems, I know that. But like it said, it's not going to happen anything to the Olympics. They're going to be run perfectly. The problem's going to be afterwards. And that's purely known. I mean, like I said, I can mention 10 at least Olympics that have bankrupt their countries. And that's really tough. It's really sad, but, hey, that's the deal with the Olympics. But, Fred. Hey, Jay Hart of Yahoo Sports, he says that PGA Tour is giving Phil Mickelson special treatment when it should suspend him. And you know what? He might have a very valid point. Fred, you mentioned last week that Phil was going to fly cross-country back home to California to see his daughter graduate from 8th grade. He returned to Oakland 2 days later on the eve of the 116,000 U.S. Open. That's the Phil Mickelson golf fans falling in love with over the last 2 decades. The expecting father losing the U.S. Open by stroke the day before his first child was born, the doting husband to his cancer-stricken wife, and the dutiful father of three who not once but twice escaped out of practice rounds for the U.S. Open to attend a child's 8th grade graduation. He's a good guy who, according to Hart, if the PGA Tour were following its own rules, wouldn't be playing in any PGA Tour event this year or the next. Here's what he's basing all this on. Page 147 of the PGA Tour player handbook, in the conduct of players section, there is a list of things players should not do. Number 3 on that list, all of which are subject to a suspension from tournament play for a minimum of 2 seasons, states the following, and I quote, associate with or having dealings with persons whose activities, including gambling, might reflect adversely upon the integrity of the game of golf, end of quote. Bill Walters is such a person. In fact, if there were only one person on earth who fits this description, it might be him. This is the man at the center of the Securities and Exchange Commission's investigation that ensnared Mickelson. According to that investigation, Walters got a stock tip from former Dean Foods chairman Thomas Davis in late July of 2012. Walters then shared the tip with his golfing buddy Mickelson, supposedly so Mickelson could invest, make a quick buck, and then pay back the gambling debt he owed to Walters. According to the SEC, on July 30 and 31st, Mickelson invested $2.4 million in Dean Foods. To that point, his stock portfolio was $250,000. He unloaded his shares of Dean Foods on August 8, 2012, at a profit of $931,000. For his part, Walters, now 69, was indicted in May for insider trading. He's currently free on a $1 million bond. Mickelson was more fortunate, as the SEC did not implicate him in its criminal case, rather named him as a relief defendant in a civil suit, which essentially means that the SEC wants the money back that he made. He was guessing Mickelson quickly cut the SEC a check for $1.05 million to receive the $931,000 plus interest, happy to be out of his crosshairs. Apparently, writing a $1 million check for making money he wasn't supposed to is nothing. And apparently, PGA Tour Commissioner Tim Fincham is equally unbothered. When he was asked in late May about the Mickelson situation, he felt like he was a great guy. He said, "I haven't spoken to him. I don't know about that." So Hart goes on to ponder to Fincham, is one of your top players, maybe your most high-profile player outside of Tiger Woods, is looped into a federal investigation involving insider trading with one of, if not the world's most notorious gamblers. Said investigation alleges a gambling debt between your player and the notorious gambler. Said player, a millionaire many times over, has a stock portfolio totaling $250,000 and suddenly invests $2.5 million in a random food and beverage company, then sells said stock a few days later for a $1 million profit, and you have nothing to say? Well, no, he doesn't. You know, this from the guy who once suspended John Daly for 6 months for essentially being John Daly, looking off on the course and spending a night in the drunk tank. Hart says it's laughable and reeks special treatment. Is Phil Mickelson a nice guy? Sure. Is he a good for the game of golf? Without question. Would it be an unfortunate end to a Hall of Fame career to suspend him? You bet it does. Fred Fincham is on his way out, but with this, he might be setting a moot point and dangerous precedent for future handling of similar situations for upcoming Jay Monahan.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of exactly what Vijay Singh is saying in his lawsuit against the PGA Tour, that some players get treated differently than other players. So, they're going to have to work on that. I think they maybe do have some problems there. And I think, you know, a couple of the guys tried to jump on Phil at Oakmont when he came in for his press conference, and, you know, he kind of sidestepped up and said he wasn't going to talk about some of that stuff. A guy was kind of really trying to get in his face about it, but Phil just said, there's no comment. So, I got a feeling the PGA Tour is going to have to do something. So if we see Phil take a long break or suddenly comes up with a wrist or shoulder or back issue and has to take some time off, we'll kind of know maybe what happened. Hey, Carlos, speaking of the USGA, we mentioned this story last week, but we didn't have time to go into it, so we brought it up again. I think it's kind of important, really. The USGA really does do a lot for the game of golf. They're not a rule setter. They're involved in running all these tournaments that involve a cross-section of golfers, not just the pros, but amateurs and juniors and women and the whole thing. So they really do a good job with what they do. And now they got $100 million to play around with every year, they should be even doing more. Well, one of the things they're working on is updating their technology and gathering information. So they've been taking the heat this week for their use of video technology, and we're going to talk about that some more in the Dustin Johnson penalty stroke situation. And they have been a little slow to accept the use of technology to help golfers and golf courses with usable data for the vast amount of information they collect. No one will ever accuse the USGA of being too techy or on the cutting edge of advanced 21st century technology, but they are beginning to realize the vast potential of data that can be harvested and used productively by golfers worldwide. Sarah Hirschland, who is the USGA Senior Manager of Business Affairs, wants to consolidate the International Handicapping System, which is just one part of the data system, to better inform member clubs of spending and playing habits, as well as improve relations with the more than 150 state and regional golf associations that they interact with. They also want to improve the information available for individual golfers, such as comparing scores on a particular hole over time or breaking down shots in a round to learn what areas to practice to help lower scores in the future. Now we're talking. This is exactly the type of forward-thinking and results-oriented information that the USGA should be providing golfers around the world. You know, this is a big positive use of their $100 million that they receive each year from Fox Sports to broadcast the USGA events. As I mentioned, the USGA may be a little slow, but when they get around to it, they do it right, Carlos. That ends the back nine report for June 21st, 2016, and that's the way it was, golf fans. United Golf Network wants every golfer to enjoy the game more and have the opportunity to earn money while doing it. They offer a top line of golf products, including popular name brands like Wilson, Greg Norman, Ashwood, TaylorMade, Adidas, and Where to Win. Everything a golfer needs, clubs, balls, bags, shoes, apparel, and accessories, are available with discount coupons for huge savings. Plus, if you're a director, you get more discounts, right, just like you're a pro shop. You can set up your own pro shop. You can sell to your buddies. You can make money. This is a great deal. People should be checking it out. Log on to UnitedGolfNetwork.com. Check out their products, discounts, and their opportunity, Carlos.
And now we're going to take another short break. When we come back, we have the practice range where we're going to be talking about the USGA's ruling on Dustin Johnson's apparent involvement in making his ball move on the fifth hole range. Don't go anywhere.
Thank you for listening to the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the practice range for every week for the night pick a topic. Each of us take our own swing at it. And this week, like I mentioned, is the USGA's ruling on Dustin Johnson's apparent involvement on making his ball move from the fifth hole green. So it's a good call, a terrible call. We'll explore all angles, commentaries from the players and golf personalities. And we also have an interview with the USGA Managing Director, Jeff Hall. Well, the way we're going to do it, I'm going to start setting it up. I'm going to talk about what happened, what the player said. After that, we're going to play the Jeff Hall interview, and Fred will start doing his take on it, and then I'll finish with my take. So let's start by saying what happened. Controversy struck on the 12th green, on the 12th tee, I mean, when the officials told Dustin Johnson they wanted to review an incident that had occurred on the fifth green. DJ was facing a par putt on the par 4 fifth when his ball clearly moved slightly after he'd made a couple of practice strokes. Johnson stood back off the putt and summoned the referee. At the time, it appeared there would be no penalty as the official and Johnson's playing partner, Lee Westwood, seemed happy that Johnson had not addressed the ball. But on the 12th, officials approached Johnson and told him there might be a one-stroke penalty and that they wanted him to review footage of the incident after the round. The other players in contention were informed of the possible penalty, but that uncertainty cast a shadow over the final holes of the tournament. That score was then pushed back to 4-under when it was decided the penalty on the fifth hole would stand. Thankfully, it made no difference to the final outcome, but the players were in an outrage. I mean, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of them. Tiger Woods, you know, he's an occasional contributor to Twitter, but the rules ruckus that the USGA caused by calling a late penalty on the U.S. Open winner Dustin Johnson riled even the Big Cat, and he said, and I quote on Twitter, "Some great golf by D. Johnson PGA all week. Strong way to finish overcoming that rules farce. Happy Father's Day to DJ and all of you." I mean, the whole bizarre incident caused an uproar across the world of golf, with players including Rory McIlroy and Jordan Spieth also tweeting their outrage. Rory McIlroy said, he sent out two tweets. The first one says, "This is ridiculous. No penalty whatsoever for DJ. Let the guy play without this crap in his head. Amateur hour from the USGA." The second one said, "This isn't right for anyone on the golf course. If it was me, I wouldn't hit another shot until this farce was rectified." Jordan Spieth, he tweeted, "Let me get this straight. DJ doesn't address it. It's ruled that he didn't cause it to move. Now you tell me he may have? Now? This is a joke." Ricky Fowler, he said, "Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy, I'm with you, boys. The fact that the USGA thinks that DJ caused the ball to move is completely ridiculous. Laughable." Ernie Els, the Big Easy, he said, "USGA treatment of Dustin Johnson, absolutely shocking. No way he made the ball move." And Luke Donald, he said, Have you seen how much these putts are breaking, USGA? The green speed and slope caused the ball to move. That's hashtag move on. And finally, according to ESPN's Ian O'Connor, even Jack Nicklaus, the Golden Bear, was on hand there to congratulate the first-time major winner in person. He weighed in on the USGA staff. He told PJ, and I quote, "I thought what you did with all that crap they threw at you was pretty good." O'Connor went on to tweet that the 18-time major champion termed the USGA's decision terrible and very unfair. Fred, you were with USGA Managing Director Jeff Hall in this interview. We're going to play it now, and then we're going to go to your comments on that and your comments on the controversy.
Yeah, Carlos, I just want to
talking with you.
I was just going to caution you. I have not listened to this. I taped it, and I just had a couple minutes earlier, and so I downloaded it so you could get it. And so I hope it sounds okay, but Jeff was very forthcoming with me. He's had so much controversy and so much thrown at him the last couple days. I couldn't really bear to get too much in his face, but he did make some great comments, and he was very nice to talk to us today.
Here it is.
We were talking with Jeff Hall, who is the rules official from the USGA. We're here at Scioto Country Club today with the media day for the U.S. Senior Open coming up here in August. And, Jeff, we're looking for a good tournament from Columbus. What are you seeing when you come out here?
Well, first and foremost, any of our championships, we're looking for a quality venue. And we've certainly got that in spades here at Scioto. Great history, but just a great test of golf. I think it will really challenge this group of players.
You've been the man of the news the last few hours, and could you just walk our listeners just real briefly through a couple of the events that caught your attention and happened at the ruling that Justin Johnson went through on Sunday at the U.S. Open?
Oh, okay. Well, yes, it all stemmed from Dustin's par putt on the fifth hole. I'm sure most have seen the video at this point. He grounded his club very near his golf ball. The ball moved proximate to his grounding of the club. And as we reviewed that, discussed it as a committee, we felt that a penalty was very likely. So in the final round of the U.S. Open, and by the time everybody looked at it, there were six, seven holes left to play. We felt we had an obligation to let Dustin know that there might very well be a penalty. We had to have a discussion with him. We wanted to know if there were other factors that could have caused the ball to move, and we entered into a discussion with Dustin on the 12th tee, put him on notice that there could very well be a problem so that he could manage his strategy for the balance of the round. We also alerted the other players playing of this possibility. We met with Dustin following the round, and after the discussion, we ended up penalizing Dustin one stroke for the situation. Subsequent to that, after everybody kind of went to bed and got up Monday, we reflected on it. We were pretty comfortable with what we did in the moment, but on reflection, we said, "Geez, is there a better way to do this?" So we will continue to talk about it and arrive at a better way for the future.
I know the USGA issued a statement about some of the actions and some of the things that went on, and maybe they could look at things a little bit differently after looking and thinking about it overnight and that kind of thing. And I know Mike Davis said maybe we made a big bogey. But for you, it's just a constant learning process. We're taking this forward and seeing where it goes in the future.
I think any good organization learns. You can't stop learning. You can't stop trying to improve. And this may be an element, an area that we can improve on. But it's not as if we could, flip open the manual and say, here's how you deal with this. It wasn't... it just wasn't quite that easy. So, again, you're dealing with it in real time, trying to manage it as best you can, trying to do what you believe is right and what is best for the player involved and the players involved. And we felt comfortable with the decision that we made while it was happening.
I got one more question for you. This is kind of a general thing. Video replay is becoming such a big factor in every sport, whether it's baseball, football, NHL, whatever. Is video replay maybe trying to be used too much or becoming too technical, even for golf?
we think we have a responsibility to ultimately get the ruling right. And whether it's video, whether it's information we get from a spectator, from a marshal, from a referee, from another player, we're trying to get all the information we can to make the most accurate ruling. There are times when video, as was the case on Sunday, helped get us to a point where a penalty had to be assessed. But there's certainly been other times in history where video has been used to absolve a player from a situation. So we still think it's a very good resource for us to use moving forward.
Jeff, thank you so much for taking a minute to talk to us.
You bet. Thanks for being here.
Good luck.
Thank you.
There you have it. That was USGA Managing Director Jeff Hall. And like you mentioned, he's been under fire. And Stutchess has been the USGA. I mean, and they yesterday said they, like he just mentioned there, they regretted creating the unnecessary ambiguity for the eventual champion Dustin Johnson and the rest of the field on Sunday's final round there of the U.S. Open at Oakland Country Club. But, you know, it caused that uproar of criticism on social media of all the players. Fred, what's your take on this?
Carlos, just my personal opinion on the whole thing, it's a lot of crap, okay? I think it's an unjustified ruling. Looking, the official made the ruling on the course, on the green. When it happened in real time, we saw it. I mean, we were watching it. And Dustin never grounded his putter behind the ball. And he called the rules official over right away and told him exactly what happened. The rules official told him what needed to be done, and he was okay, and away we go. That should have been it. That should have been said, done, end of game, over, right there. Well, lo and behold, we've got videotape. And some guy sitting in a room in a trailer, you know, several hundred yards away from the actual fact, said, oh, this doesn't look right. That ball moved. He must have caused it to move. Those greens are so fast. They were 15 on the stem meter. You know how fast they, did you ever try to putt 15 stem greens? Try to putt on your kitchen table. That's about what it's like. There's nothing to stop it. And then put two books or three books under one side of your table, under the legs, and now try to putt it and try to stop the ball downhill. No way. Pretty much the same way on those greens. I was watching guys on Tuesday and Wednesday chipping into greens from the rough, and they couldn't keep the ball on the green. And they were hitting the front part of the green. It would roll off either side. It wouldn't stay on. I don't know how they think these guys are supposed to play on stuff like that. So a puff of wind could have blown that ball. You know, a blade of grass could have moved and moved the ball. You know what? They make a big deal about it. He set the putter down in his practice stroke. He set the putter down beside the ball. He picked the putter up. When he moved behind it, then the ball moved. The putter sitting down on the ground beside it didn't cause it to move. It just moved. So, anyhow, that's my personal opinion, Carlos. I've ranted enough about that. So I'll get back here to what I've got noted here that, you know, Mike Perkey in Global Golf Post said it's a travesty. He said that in an article in Global Golf Post this week. The majority of the tour players took to Twitter to rebuke the USGA. You gave us some examples of that. Rory, Jordan, several other players stuck up for Dustin. Even Jack Nicklaus, when he congratulated Dustin as he walked off the 18th green yesterday, on Sunday, congratulated him as putting up with all the crap that he was getting from the USGA. And I don't know if you saw it or not, Carlos, but Golf Channel met with Jeff Hall and Tom Pagel of the USGA and with Frank Nabilo and Rich Lerner, and Brandel pretty much jumped in the USGA's face. He didn't see any way that ruling should have been made, any way which, and even if they did make, and then once they did make, they made it wrong. So another interesting point about this whole thing was Fox you know, Azinger and Brad Faxon kind of disagreed with the Hall and with Pagel when they were in the booth there while Dustin was playing the back nine. You know, and Fox is paying USGA $1 billion for the life of the contract to air all these tournaments. I got a feeling USGA was not too excited about Azinger and Brad Faxon asking some fairly probing questions during that time. So anyhow, to move on, I don't understand why the USGA decided to relook at it on video. Yeah, the ball moved, but I don't know. I don't know why they think they can do a better job. But this whole video thing, Carlos, in football, baseball, basketball, and now golf, I just think it's completely over the top. We got to go to the tape on every play, everything. It just, it's, I don't like it. Someone needs to come to their senses, and technology is just not the answer in every situation. There's a really good article written by Jim McCabe in this week's Golf Week, and I'm going to quote it here. For all their faults, the NFL, NBA, MLB, and NHL have a clear line between who plays the game and who officiates it. Golf, if it wants to be in the big leagues, has to leave Neverland and stop thinking that it can have it all ways. It wants players to call penalties on themselves, then it wants to take calls from fans and call penalties on players from videotape. Then it wants to be in the age of instant replay, but only if players get to sit in and watch. So, Carlos, I think this kind of sums it up nicely. Golf has to decide if it's going to be a gentleman's game and value the time-honored call-your-own-penalties, or is it going to become a video replay-dependent just like other professional sports? So, bottom line, I just, when I'm watching it the other day, I couldn't believe that they would call that penalty. I thought that's what the new rules were in place for exactly situations like that when the ball moves. As long as the player doesn't ground his putter behind the ball, it doesn't cause it to move. How does a ball move backwards, you know, if a player caused it to move? It just doesn't make any sense to me in any way, shape, or form. I think they are so lucky that it didn't impact the outcome of the tournament. Can you imagine if he'd lost by one shot, or if it tied and he'd lost in a playoff? Oh, my goodness. This is minor compared to what it could have been. I think they messed this up big time. They realize it now, and they're going to be changing things going forward, Carlos.
You know, on the point that you mentioned about how fast the greens were, before the tournament started or during it on Thursday, Curtis Strange made a demonstration. He went to one of the greens and put a ball, and he just did a small blow on the ball. The ball went 25 feet, okay, with a small blow of his mouth, okay, like he was blowing a candle, and the ball moved 25 feet. So that's how fast it was. And on the Fox telecast, remember Jeff Hall said that he told Johnson that the actions he took very well could have caused the ball to move. And Hall said Johnson told him, I don't believe I caused the ball to move. You know, officials looking at the replay indicated that unless Johnson could provide another reason for the ball to move, a gust of wind, et cetera, he would be deemed to have made the ball move and would be assessed a penalty stroke at the end of the round. At that moment, and I remember texting you saying, that is baloney, the decision has already been made, he will be docked a stroke. But that uncertainty around the penalty shot brought back memories to me of the PGA Tour Championship with Whistling Straits in 2010. When DJ grounded his club in a bunker on the 72nd hole and incurred in a one-shot penalty, thereby missing a playoff by a shot. But thankfully, this time, he wasn't to be denied, and he finally got over the line in first place to claim his first major title. But it was a superb performance by him. He showed great grit, determination, in that face of adversity after the possible penalty was announced. But that really doesn't excuse the USGA of what they did, and are deserving of facing and receiving all the criticism over the way they managed the situation. That uncertainty over the ruling clear effect to the players, Shane Lowry was shaky in particular, but he was more after that, and he questioned why the penalty wasn't enforced immediately, making it clear what was required of the contenders on the run for home. While his peers could not contain that displeasure that went down, I mean, Johnson, true to his laid-back persona, he took it all in stride, and for his part, he weathered the storm with grace and fortitude. But look, officials everywhere, on every sport, they make mistakes. If the official on the course at the moment, according to the USGA's decision afterwards, was wrong, so be it. That's what happened. Deal it afterwards. I mean, cut your losses and get better at dealing with it next time, just like Jeff Hall said in the interview. To me, it's as ridiculous as the NBA suspending Draymond Green when the call on the court was deemed not worthy of it. And it didn't cost the marbles to move and be put in his head for that. He reacted afterwards, right? But the BS decision by the NBA changing the outcome of the series and the championship, I mean, sorry, I have to throw this one out there. It's another one I'm still feeling about. But now on the matter at hand, the game is played on the field by the players and the officials on it rule over it. Once play is over, you should not change the outcome regardless of the consequence. Like in the NFL with the replays, if there's no conclusive evidence, they don't change the call. The USGA admits it was a judgment call because it's based on what they call their experience on those situations by what they saw. Well, no one in their right mind, even then, can say conclusively that DJ made the ball move. It was their guess, and everybody else in the world is against that. But, I mean, what happened on the field stays there, and the decision, even though it didn't change the outcome, was one of the worst ever taken. And, of course, the USGA is too proud. I mean, they won't take it back and admit they were wrong. Even when that would be the right thing to do, they should do it. Hey, like you said, the Mike Davis said, maybe we make a big bogey out of it. No, it wasn't a big bogey. It was a triple bogey here. And it really is going to come back to hunt them.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we've seen similar kind of things. You know, remember a couple years back, Tiger in the drop at 15 after he hit the ball in the water. And then, you know, there was some controversy, but before he left the course, they had it sorted out. The official said, it's okay, it's all done. And it was, and then the next morning they called him in again. They looked at it overnight, and they decided he didn't drop the ball in proximity. Well, what is proximity? You know, is it 6 inches? Is it 3 feet? Is it 2 yards? What's proximity? So, you know, and then he ended up getting a penalty, if you recall. In this case, too, you know, the official on site took care of it. It should have been done. It shouldn't have gone any farther than that. It was over. You know, if anybody wants to make a big deal, the ruling he got on the other hole where he got to take it from the deep rough over into the fairway, that was a bigger deal to me than this thing right here. So it's a big deal. I don't know how they're going to handle it in the future. I think videotape, I think this replay thing is completely over the top on all sports, not only just golf. So I don't know what they're going to do, but they've got to change something. It's just, it's too much. And then the other factor of this thing that we've talked about is the speeds of these greens. Trying to play on 15-stem greens with the kind of undulation that those greens have, they have for major, it's just stupid. It's stupid to set these courses up like that. I don't know why they do it. It's just, it's asinine, Carlos.
Well, we'll leave it at that. I think we've given enough of our opinions, and there's been a lot of – I think that everybody agrees the only people here, you know, stubborn enough to keep saying that it was right is the USGA. So we'll see what happens. Hopefully they better in. I just think the video replays would just add more time to the rounds. Would stop play, and that's not something that the players are accustomed to, and I don't think it should work that way. But anyway, we'll see what they do to really get it better. To me, they should just forget about the video replay, like you mentioned. Whatever is ruled in there, it takes, that's it. But before we move on, Fred, I mean, let's now address the other scandal there, and I mean Paulina Gretzky's dress. I mean, sure.
You're stealing my thunder.
I'll decide later about that. But as you remember, I mean, Paulina Gretzky, she followed DJ off the steps of the Oakland Country Club Sunday wearing a short, tight white dress. And the cameraman followed the couple in a stalker-esque manner following Johnson's final hole, shifting his focus mostly towards Gretzky instead of the major champion. Who does that in their right mind? I mean, of course it should have been done.
Carlos.
The camera zoomed into Gretzky's lower body as she pulled her skirt down to lower her legs. But, I mean, this is the real controversy here. The Twitterverse exploded with divided reactions. I mean, some celebrated the cameraman's action, while others said it was unprofessional. What's your take on this controversy?
You're killing me here. This is my. I had this all set up. You're killing me. You stole my thunder here, buddy. Perhaps it was the best shot of the entire U.S. Open at Altamont, with Paulina climbing the stairs, pulling her dress down. You know, that baby was tight. you know what? It's just it's become a big thing on social media. If you notice, you know, while Dustin was putting out, finishing up on 18, they got the mandatory shot of the wife, and you know she's standing there holding the baby, and a little tear comes out of her eye. She played her role perfectly. You know, she hit all her marks. And it was just hilarious. I could just see every woman in the world as she's walking. Well, she wouldn't wear such a tight dress. It wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't have to be doing that. Yeah, that was hilarious. That really was. Yeah.
So you see, fans, listeners, we cover everything.
We got every angle covered. Exactly.
We got it covered, so don't miss that. Let's take our last short break, and when we come back, we'll have our final thoughts for you, so don't go anywhere. We still have some more.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our final thoughts, and we'll start talking about the Asian Tour, who yesterday unveiled a new flagship event, which the Holtram Players Championship, which will take place from April 13 to the 16th next year at the Bluffs Holtram Strip, marking a historic occasion for the tour there in Vietnam, making its members and the nation of Vietnam proud. The inaugural Holtram Open set a new standard in golf and entertainment last December, with Sergio Garcia of Spain triumphing on the course at the end of the week filled with world-class entertainment. The event was ultimately recognized as the Asian Tour's 2015 Event of the Year and set the foundation for the launch of the Tour's new flagship event, the Holtram Players Championship. Ki La Han, who is the commissioner of the Asian Tour, says it will offer the highest purse on the Asian Tour, $1.2 million. Sergio will be there, but I see it difficult, really, for many top players to go due to the fact that it's the week after the Masters. Maybe they should work that out to see if they can attract many more of the top players. Joel Alexander, who spent 10 years as a media official for the PGA Tour, has been named Director of Operations of Auburn's men's and women's golf teams. Head coaches Nick Lennart and Melissa Lulin announced Thursday. Alexander comes from Auburn from Gainesville, Florida, where she previously worked for Gator IMG Sports Marketing, managing fulfillment for the University of Florida's athletics rights holder. She has most recently worked as a health and fitness instructor and as a senior underwriting assistant. Alexander replaces Mary Robb Plunkett, who recently accepted a position as an assistant athletic director at the University of North Georgia. And finally, Jordan Newbridge, a two-time U.S. Walker Cup player and last year's low amateur at the Open Championship at St. Andrews, will make his professional debut at the PGA Tour's Quicken Loans National this week. Look out for this 22-year-old. He's 6'4", can generate plus swing speeds, have rare touch and skill around the greens, and own a golf IQ that is off the charts. Fred, those attributes have helped him be the most accomplished amateur in the century-plus history of Wisconsin golf, a history that includes the names of North, Stricker, Kendall, Wilson, and Steinhauer.
Pretty good names. Hey, Carlos, I just got a couple things here to wrap up tonight. The Dunvegan Hotel is an iconic hotel and bar that sits near St. Andrews. It's one of the must-see places to get a pint and see the sights when visiting the old course. The owners, Texan Jack Willoughby and his Scottish wife, Sheena, have owned the Dunvegan for 22 years, but they have decided to hang it up and retire. They put the famous watering hole up for sale for a mere price of 3 million sterling, and I didn't do the conversion over that, but I'm guessing it's around, what, 4 or 5 million bucks or so? Everyone from Clint Eastwood and Sean Connery to George W. Bush and Neil Armstrong have passed through the doors and found a friendly seat in the Dunvegan. It has hosted over 30 major champions, including Tiger Woods. Sounds like a bargain, Carlos. You want to get in the bar business? Hey, the U.S. Open just closed at Oakmont last week, but tickets are on sale now for the 2017 U.S. Open at Erin Hills in Wisconsin that you just mentioned. You can find them, go online to USGA.org. You can find those tickets. There was a great story about Ernie Els and his autistic son in the New York Times. If you just Google Ernie Els and New York Times inner voice, you'll find the article. It was written on June 13th. Very good article. Jim Furyk had a great tournament, finished runner-up at Oakmont in the U.S. Open. And with that finish, he moved up 33 spots from number 50 to number 17 in the Ryder Cup points list. Dustin Johnson gained ground on number one ranked Jordan Spieth and is now only 900 points behind the number two ranked player in the world. So, Carlos, we covered all the controversy from Oakmont. We talked about Oakmont from A to Z. We even got Pauline in there. I don't know what else we can cover. I think that's our show for tonight.
Yes, that's it. Back Niners. That will wrap up another week of the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com, full of everything that you wanted to know. Thanks for listening to us. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks to Jeff Hall for being with you there for that interview. Very insightful for him. Thank you for him to be with us. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio. Or if you missed it, check it out on iTunes or tune in. And if you haven't done so, follow the show. Our Twitter ID is at Back9Report, the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres, along with Fred Alvader. We wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.